Well, I'm going to be lecturing about symmetry breaking, but mainly, after the introduction, mainly supersymmetry breaking. In flat space quantum field theory. So, by the way, I'm quite sure that most of the physicists will find what I'll say today to be extremely elementary. So maybe I should have tried to think of a title that would discourage some of you from coming. We'll start with the general notion of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So first we'll consider a global symmetry. In fact, first we'll consider a finite group. For example, Z2. So classically, spontaneous symmetry breaking just means that the minimum energy state isn't Z2 invariant. So for example, we have a scalar field phi, which is real, and Z2 acts by changing the sign of phi. And we have a potential energy, which is something like a constant times phi squared minus a squared squared. So the potential looks something like so. Now, if you consider a quantum mechanical particle with such a potential, you can start it in one side or the other of the well, but it will tunnel to the other side. So a quantum mechanical state of a particle will be an admixture of states on the two sides. However, if you go to a quantum field theory in dimension bigger than one, then at fixed time, well, phi, first of all, is a function of x and position and time. And at fixed time, say time zero, phi is spread throughout all space. So if phi is everywhere on one side or the other, it has a huge barrier against trying to get to the other side, because it would have to hop over to the other side everywhere in space. So if space is really infinite, then you can be stuck on one side or the other. So in dimension bigger than one, what happens in such a theory is that there are two quantum vacuum states, one of which, this is, let's say, for lambda sufficiently small and A big, then the classical approximation is a good approximation. And for those values of the parameters, the quantum answer will be what the classical picture suggests, which is two vacuum states, one where phi is localized near A and one where phi is localized near minus A. And those two vacua are exchanged by the symmetry. So the physics of an observer who's measuring particle masses and the S matrix excited around one vacuum isn't Z2 invariant. The Z2 just exchanges you with another solution of the same axioms of the quantum field theory in which phi is negative instead of positive on the average. Now, a somewhat more interesting example. Any questions about that, by the way? Yes?
Well, suppose you're in 1 plus 1 space-time.
Yes.
You take advantage of all this work of constructive.
Yes. What I said, everything I've said are rigorous terms in this example in 1 plus 1 dimensions. Anything else? Other questions? In fact, even the example I'm going to get to in a moment, it will be rigorous in 2 plus 1 dimensions. The next example is a continuous symmetry group. Let's say a connected, well, it needn't be connected, but we could, for instance, consider the case where the symmetry group is a connected Lie group G, but the vacuum is only invariant under a subgroup H. Well, if this is so, then here, temporarily, you can think of vacuum as, in the classical sense, as the minimum of the classical energy. If this is so, since a vacuum only has H symmetry, but G acts on the problem, well, the space of vacua, if there's no other degeneracy, so if the space of vacua is a single orbit of G, then the space of vacua will be a copy of the homogeneous space V mod H. Let's give a very concrete example of this. So let G be SON and H be SON minus 1. And then we can take a scalar field psi consisting of n real fields in the n-dimensional representation of SON. And then we write essentially the same potential as before. And now, the minimum of potential is at phi squared equals a squared, which, of course, defines a sphere of radius a. The only difference from the previous example is that the sphere has positive energy, sorry, positive dimension, and is in particular connected. So this sphere is a copy of G mod H, of course, where H is the subgroup of G that leaves fixed a given point on the sphere. And so I'll here just try to draw the sphere rather than the space it's embedded in. This is the moduli space of minima of the energy, which is a copy of G mod H. If you look at it classically, to minimize the energy classically, you should live somewhere on the sphere. And then if you want to consider very low energy excitations, it's important that in contrast to the previous example, there are continuous variations of the vacuum that leave fixed the energy. So now, if in space we let the position on the sphere vary very slowly throughout space, the energy will be very small. So we have very low energy excitations. Which are given by maps of Rn to G mod H, which here was a sphere. I better not call it n. It's Rk, where if we're in k-dimensional Minkowski space, k-dimensional Euclidean or Minkowski space. So going over to the quantum theory, we led to conjecture that the low-energy description of this theory might be a sigma model of maps of space to the sphere. And that's true under the same conditions as before, A large and lambda small. But its consequence is quite different depending on the value of K. If K is bigger than 2, the sigma model is infrared free, and a classical description of it is valid. But if K is equal to 2, the sigma model with this positively curved target space is an asymptotically free theory that will develop strong coupling in the infrared and will eventually give surprises. So the case where we can say something simple is really k equals 3, where the scalar field theory with these fields can be supernormalizable and within the reach of rigorous methods that Greg Zitterman asked about a moment ago. And we don't, that part would still be true for k equals 2. But for k equals 2, we would eventually run into strong coupling in the infrared. So for k equals 3, you actually have a mathematical theorem saying that the space of vacua in the quantum theory is this sphere, and that these small excitations tangent to the sphere are massless particles. Yes? Well, yes, there is some such reason. So I could give you the formal reason, but I'd first like to remind you of the informal reason, which I said before, but perhaps didn't stress enough. So I stated it before in this picture, but now let's restate it in this picture. If you start with a quantum mechanical particle that's somewhere on the sphere, it will, in a finite amount of time, spread over the whole sphere. Its wave function will spread over the whole sphere. However, if we're in a sufficiently high dimension, then we've got a field that lives all throughout Rk minus 1. And it's much more difficult for that to spread. So if k is sufficiently large, then if you start out with the field everywhere localized, it will stay there. So you can self-consistently arrive at a vacuum state that's localized near a given point on the sphere. Now, of course, my language, like localized near a given point, is a weak coupling, somewhat informal description. The rigorous statement is that there's a family of vacua that have that are parametrized in this fashion. Now, k large enough, actually, so k should be bigger than 2. For the discrete case, k bigger than 1 was enough to prevent the transition from one vacuum to the other. There's a much more subtle phenomenon that we won't go into today, where for the continuous space, if k is 2, you manage effectively to make transitions between the different regions because of the fact it's not self-consistent to assume otherwise, because the sigma model with this target space becomes strongly coupled in the infrared. I've given you an informal reason, but now I'll give you the formal reason, which I think you were anxious to ask for. So part of the axioms characterizing what you mean by a quantum field theory are what's called cluster decomposition. So cluster decomposition says that if you've got two observables that are very far away, or any two observables, the limit of this as x minus y goes to infinity is a product. If you try to take a superposition, you'll spoil cluster decomposition. The reason is, if you take a superposition, you'll simply end up with a sum of these products over all points on the sphere, or a continuous integral if it's a continuous space. So, a systematic, rigorous presentation of this, we should have discussed what a quantum vacuum was, that cluster decomposition was one of the axioms, and how it fails in these situations, where informally you can see that you can set up the theory with different assumptions about what the vacuum is. The reason I'm not going into those things today is that I think that would make a lecture out of the non-supersymmetric case, and I was planning to zero in on spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. Any other questions? So one of the most important things in this example is that in the quantum theory, there are massless particles tangent to the sphere. So informally, that's because if you start in a given vacuum and make a symmetry rotation infinitesimally, that doesn't change the energy. So something that doesn't change the energy must be the creation of a massless particle at zero momentum. Of course, you're not really supposed to go to zero momentum because it would be unnormalizable. So what you do instead is that if you've got one of the symmetry currents, which mathematicians would call a k minus 1 form, so it could be integrated over rk minus 1. There are several of them, so you've got several charges. And we're interested in the ones that don't annihilate the vacuum, the ones that are trying to generate rotations of the vacuum. If you literally integrate the symmetry current over rk minus 1, you get a symmetry. If the integral converges, you get something that commutes with the Hamiltonian. But the integral may not converge. So to be safe, you multiply by a test function that's 0 at infinity. F looks something like this. So at infinity, you do nothing just to make sure that the integral converges. F varies very slowly, so everywhere it's almost constant. And being everywhere almost constant, it everywhere looks almost like a symmetry transformation. And therefore, this operator doesn't quite commute with the Hamiltonian. But it can come as close to commuting with the Hamiltonian as you want in the limit that F varies more and more slowly. So QFA, acting on the vacuum, produces a family of states which, if the states don't converge to zero, will look like very long wavelength excitations of the massless particle. The state will converge to zero if we pick a Q that leaves the given vacuum invariant. In fact, that'll be the case where we could set F equals 1 and the definition converges. So that for the Qs that don't leave the vacuum invariant, we won't quite converge as F goes to 1, but the energy of those states will go to zero. That's the quantum version of the sort of more informal classical fact that obviously small, slowly varying oscillations tangent to the sphere will have very low energy. If there aren't any questions, then we'll go to supersymmetry, where we will be more thorough. So what we'll really focus on is now spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. Well, it's got a few features that are different from the bosonic case. Quite different. So, for instance, we now let G be super Poincaré, and H be Poincaré. Of course, there are different possibilities for the dimension of space and for how many supersymmetries there are. There may, in addition, be global symmetries beyond the space-time symmetries, but I'll suppress them from the exposition for the time being. They would behave like in the discussion we just had. Now we want to look at the case where G is broken to H, which will mean that the vacuum only has H symmetry. So in our previous experience, we had then more than one vacuum. But here we won't, which for mathematicians we might describe in the following way, perhaps in the spirit of one of the lectures you heard from Dan Fried. The moduli space of vacua should be a cohomogeneous space, G mod H. But bosonically, G and H are the same. So G mod H is of dimension 0/n. It's purely fermionic, and the purely fermionic manifold only has one point, since fermions don't have values. So there's only going to be one vacuum. But although there's only one vacuum, it's, of course, not invariant under supersymmetry. So many things will happen that are characteristic of the symmetry breaking we've seen. First I'll mention something that's different and then something which is similar. One very important characteristic feature is that the energy of the vacuum will be bigger than zero if and only if supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. That's because there's a formula in a supersymmetric theory that the Hamiltonian is the sum of the squares of the supercharges. So the Hamiltonian leaves an invariant a state. The Hamiltonian annihilates a state if and only if the Q is annihilated. So if omega is the vacuum, it follows from this formula that the vacuum energy is zero if and only if the Q is annihilated the vacuum. So we have a criterion for supersymmetry breaking, which is really different in flavor from what one has for classical symmetries, which is that supersymmetry breaking is the statement that the energy of the vacuum is positive. Now, second statement is that supersymmetry breaking, for brevity, I'm calling it supersymmetry breaking, but we always mean spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. We're considering theories that are in fact supersymmetric, but where the vacuum may not be invariant under supersymmetry. That's called spontaneous breaking. So supersymmetry breaking implies the existence of a massless fermion. That's seen either informally or also formally, although I didn't give the formal proof before, exactly as we did for bosonic symmetries. In other words, one of these Qs is the integral over Rk minus 1. Well, in case supersymmetry is unbroken, there's a current S, which is a K minus 1 form with spinner values, whose integral over an initial time surface is the Q. Well, to be safe, we'd better again put in a test function and define Q alpha F. And then as F converges to 1, one of two things happen. Either the states Q alpha F on the vacuum converge to zero, that's the case where supersymmetry is unbroken, or their norms don't go to zero, but since their energies are extremely small, that gives zero energy excitations of the vacuum. And those zero energy excitations of the vacuum are fermionic because Q is fermionic. So when supersymmetry is spontaneously broken, you'll get a massless fermion that goes with it. Now, I thought instead of proving these assertions, we'd work out some little examples where we would just calculate. And I think you'd understand it better on the first pass by calculating rather than by my trying to whip out a proof. But before we actually calculate an example where we'll see these two properties, I should say three. Okay. But three is part of what we mean by spontaneous breaking, but I'm just going to state it again to reiterate the point. Bosons and fermions have equal masses, and all other consequences of supersymmetry hold, if and only if supersymmetry is unbroken. Well, I better put that in quotes because you could invent strange exceptions. If supersymmetry is broken, and normally only if. In other words, what statement 3 means that the normal consequences of any symmetry only hold when the symmetry annihilates the vacuum. Otherwise, the symmetry for bosonic symmetries maps the vacuum to a different vacuum. For supersymmetry, it's a little bit more mysterious, since there isn't quite a different vacuum. But the same general idea holds. The consequences of the symmetry are only true in the usual form if the symmetry annihilates the vacuum. So as I've said, instead of giving proofs, I was going to compute for the most elementary example. I thought the most elementary example was to consider a bunch of chiral superfields, in three or four dimensions. The two cases are slightly different, but I'll take four dimensions. And then we'll take n equals 1 supersymmetry. And we'll introduce chiral superfields. I should have checked, perhaps, whether you explained what they were last week. Yes? We have chiral superfields A1 up to AN. These are complex-valued fields on superspace. You could generalize it to maps of superspace to a Kähler manifold, but we won't really need the generalization. So the A's are a map from superspace, which we could call R4/4, to Cn. And we give Cn a Kähler metric. It doesn't have to be flat. We'll take a general Kähler metric. And then we introduce a holomorphic function, which is called the superpotential. In the usual superspace construction, it corresponds to a term in the Lagrangian that looks like this. And then if you're familiar with the usual superspace constructions and the integration over the thetas and all that, you can calculate two things. One is that the potential energy, the ordinary potential, after doing the theta integrals and reducing to an ordinary Lagrangian, the ordinary potential is the length squared with respect to the Kähler metric of the Hessian, of the gradient, dW, which we could write more fastidiously. Like so. That's one important thing. That's this equation is really why Moore's theory comes into supersymmetry. This shows that V is 0 if and only if dW is 0. So critical points of W correspond to classical states of unbroken supersymmetry. Here we were in four dimensions, so W was a holomorphic function of complex variables, which is rather special for Moore's theory. But if we'd been in three dimensions, W would simply be a smooth function of real variables. And then we would have been closer to real Moore's theory. The other thing which we should know is the fermion mass matrix. Each of these chiral superfields, I should have used a different symbol for the chiral superfield and its bosonic part. Each of the chiral superfields is an ordinary field plus theta times a fermion plus a so-called auxiliary field. And the mass matrix for the fermions involves, well, roughly speaking, the Hessian of W, except that you've got to calculate the second derivative using the current second derivative, using the Riemannian metric. That's the term in the Lagrangian that gives the fermion mass matrix. You discover the fermion masses. You discover that just by doing the theta integrals again. Well, there are two kinds of thetas. There are two kinds of spinners in four dimensions, the plus spinners and the minus spinners. I'm calling them theta and theta bar, respectively. So the complex conjugate term I'd write as you see, well, I don't really want to integrate out the auxiliary field to calculate this formula. But this one we get more quickly. We have d4x d2 theta of w of a. And we want to do the theta integral, which we do using the fact that for spinners, the integral d2 theta is like taking the second derivative with respect to theta and setting theta equals 0. And then we have the fact that psi is dA d theta at theta equals 0. So when we calculate the d2 theta integral, which is the same as the second theta derivative, we get a couple of terms, one of which is quadratic in the first derivative of A times the second derivative of W. Okay, well, that much we can get. We get two terms. One involves the second derivative of W. Then psi comes in by being the first derivative of A at theta equals 0. And the second term involves the first derivative only of A times this auxiliary field F, where I'm using that F is the second derivative at theta equals 0. And psi is the first derivative at theta equals 0. So this is the fermion mass term. And as for this term, well, it contains the auxiliary fields, which we maybe don't like. So we integrate them out using the classical equations. And when we integrate them out, we get something quadratic in this expression. And that becomes the term in the Lagrangian, which is the potential energy, which is the square of the gradient of W. That comes from here by integrating out F. But you have to add the complex conjugate and then integrate out of. Okay. So, shall I assume I've said enough about this? Or are there more questions here? Well, now what we're supposed to do is to find the minima of V. Remember, the claim is that A minimum One of our claims is that a minimum of V has dW equals 0, has V equals 0, I should say. And that's the case of unbroken supersymmetry. Or has a massless fermion. And then, in that case, it has no generic equality of Bose-Fermi masses. You might get it by adjusting parameters, but if V isn't zero, there's a massless fermion, but no generic degeneracy in the masses. That's the case of broken supersymmetry. Well, we can get that quite easily. If we just look for even a local minimum of V, we differentiate V with respect to A. We find that 0 should equal the second derivative of A, of W, with respect to A. Times this vector. Also, we have, of course, the complex conjugate equation, which I won't write separately. And now we see that there are two cases. For this to be 0, one case is that dW bar dA bar is 0. That means that dW is 0 and V is 0 and supersymmetry is unbroken. The second case is that dW bar dA bar is not 0. And in that case, obviously, if it's not 0, it's in the kernel of the Hessian, so to speak, the holomorphic Hessian. And since the holomorphic Hessian was the fermion mass matrix, we see that there's a massless fermion. It's in the kernel of the fermion mass matrix. So we have a massless fermion. We also have non-zero V, because V is the square of this non-zero vector. And we generically have no massless bosons, because the function V, well, in this situation, we found a local minimum of that function V at which it's non-zero. And for a generic Kähler metric, everything being generic, that'll be a non-degenerate minimum of V. In other words, the Hessian of the real function V will be non-degenerate. So there will be no massless bosons. And in particular, generically, the bosons and fermions don't have equal masses, and the usual consequences of supersymmetry don't hold. There's no problem. For example, in two or three dimensions, they would even be rigorous. In fact, in two or three dimensions, we could do this much more easily, because there would be half as much supersymmetry, so W would have merely been a real function. We could take a real polynomial on Rn with no critical points, and such that dW grows at infinity. Then everything will be completely under control and even rigorous there. If you want to ask a little bit more informally, not whether it's rigorous, but when we would expect it to be true, when we would be confident. Here we've given a classical deduction. So for rigorous theorems, we go to two or three dimensions. But now let's make some not rigorous, but nevertheless.
Yeah,
You will eventually. What? You want to hear about the index? We'll get there eventually. But you see, well, we can't get there yet for a variety of reasons. So, I think what Pierre's question was is, if we find this picture classically with supersymmetry either broken or not broken, in other words, the lowest energy state was either of this kind or of this kind, under what conditions can we be confident that the quantum answer is the same as the classical answer? So, I'll give some obvious sufficient criteria. Well, first of all, I shouldn't reverse one and two. So continuing with that numbering, Susie breaking is inherently stable. Well, modulus some compactness. Because the criterion is that V is positive. So if in any valid approximation you've calculated that V is positive, then in an open set around there, V is positive. So Susie breaking is inherently stable if you've got some compactness. What I mean by some compactness is that, here's the bad case. If we calculate V depending on a field, and we get an answer that looks like this, where the minimum appears to be above zero, but as we go to infinity, V doesn't go to infinity, then there's a potential non-uniformity in our approximation. We'd have to prove that our approximation was not just valid locally on the A-plane, but was valid uniformly near infinity. But if there isn't such a problem with compactness, then supersymmetry breaking is inherently stable. Well, supersymmetry unbreaking isn't inherently stable, because the criterion is that V is zero, which isn't an open condition. But we can say something weaker, but still very important, which is that unbroken supersymmetry is stable if there's an S-cap. Because, well, if supersymmetry is broken, there's a massless fermion and no mass gap. Having a mass gap is an open condition. It says that all masses are positive. So under a small perturbation, that remains true. And since we can't have a mass gap when supersymmetry is broken, it follows that unbroken supersymmetry is stable if there's a mass gap. Now, a lot of the most interesting supersymmetric theories have unbroken supersymmetry classically and don't have a mass gap classically. So these criteria don't settle many of the most interesting cases. But those are the most obvious criteria. In fact, we're going to be heading for other criteria by which you can settle some of the more interesting cases. Ian's asked me to view the supercharge as an operator from even to odd states and compute its index, but we can only do that if we know what the Hilbert space is. If you have a Hilbert space, then in that Hilbert space you can define an operator, perhaps, and perhaps discuss its index. But in quantum field theory, until we found the vacuum, we don't really know what the Hilbert space was. That's why, in the spirit of this discussion, which was an infinite volume, I couldn't proceed along the lines you asked about. There's something we can do for supersymmetry. I should check again if there are more questions about what I said so far. Okay. So these were the obvious criteria, and they settle a lot of cases, but we'd like to know more. So we can settle some of the fun cases, like supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, where these criteria don't tell us anything. or likewise supersymmetric sigma models. So we're going to do something which doesn't have an analog for ordinary symmetries, but does work for global for supersymmetry. And that is that we're going to work in finite volume. So instead of RK, now, we'll only give now a criterion. We'll give a better criterion for unbroken supersymmetry. Better meaning that it will settle many of the cases where supersymmetry is unbroken classically but without a mass gap. I won't be able, unfortunately, to give you a better criterion for broken supersymmetry. There are cases where there are results, but they are based on much more special methods, which I won't talk about. Much more special methods adapted to particular problems. Whereas we're now going to discuss a general strategy based eventually on a kind of index theory, which gives an interesting criterion for unbroken supersymmetry. So the idea is that instead of RK, well, RK was time times space. We're going to take space to be compact. So we'll work on R, which will be time, times a K minus 1 torus. Now, for global symmetries, ordinary global symmetries, that would completely flunk as a method of exploring symmetry breaking. The reason is that as soon as space is a finite volume, the wave function will automatically tunnel between all the possible vacua or explore all of G mod H. So you'll never see symmetry breaking for ordinary symmetries if you take space to be compact. For supersymmetry, you sometimes can as follows. So we calculate, so we let E of V, so we let V be the volume of space, and E of V, the minimum energy, as a function of V. If we can prove that E of V is 0 for all V, then it will be 0 in the limit, and that corresponds to unbroken supersymmetry. If E of V is 0 for all V, that implies that E of infinity is 0, and supersymmetry is unbroken. There's again a subtlety about compactness that we could worry about. You see, the way it happens is as follows. You could have something like this, where the minimum is at A equals V. And then as V goes to infinity, the limiting theory would have its minimum at infinity. And then the limiting theory actually wouldn't have a stable vacuum at all. It would have no positive lower bounds on the energy, but it wouldn't have a stable vacuum. So to completely draw this inference from E of V being 0 for all finite V, we need to know something about compactness. Usually, in our interesting examples where the more obvious criteria don't fail, well, I shouldn't say usually, but in many of them, such as the ones we'll actually discuss, there's no real problem with compactness. Because the classical theory has the property that if you try to go to infinity in any direction, the energy would grow. Well, okay. The subtleties all arise from strong quantum effects, which don't happen when the fields are big, at least at a non-rigorous level. But we should, again, worry about some compactness when V goes to infinity, although in practice we won't have to. Well, why would E of V be identically 0 for all finite V? You see, the question of supersymmetry breaking makes sense for finite V, and the criterion is the same. It's still true that the Hamiltonian is the sum of squares of the supercharges. We gain a number of things, though, from being in finite volume. One is that the Qs commute as operators whether or not supersymmetry would have been broken for infinite volume. In defining the Qs, we're integrating over a compact space, and there's no issue of convergence of the integral. is just an integral over a torus. So Q is defined more fundamentally and related to the fact that conventional symmetry breaking doesn't happen in finite volume. In finite volume, we know what the Hilbert space is a priori. And so there's a definite Hilbert space in which we're working. And therefore, we have the potential setup for something such as index theory. So this formula, which still holds, gives us the basic fact that the energy is zero in volume V, if and only if the Qs annihilate one of the quantum states in volume V. So we have to search for a state annihilated by the Qs. So we've got the momenta, which are P. We work in the subspace of Hilbert space with momentum zero. There's no loss there because one easily proves from the supersymmetry algebra that the Hamiltonian is at least as big as the momentum. The proof of that works fine in finite volume. So if there is a zero energy state, it also has zero momentum. Then we let Q equal any linear combination, let's say any real linear combination, of the Q alphas. And then we have a formula that H is Q squared up to a constant. And Q maps Bose states to Fermi states and Fermi states to Bose states. So this is the basic situation of index theory. Now we can define the index of Q. Which is the number of even states of H equals zero minus the number of odd states of H equals zero. Physicists usually define the operator minus one to the F, which is one and minus one for even and odd states. So the index is, if you want, trace minus 1 to the f times e to the minus beta h, independent of beta. The reason for that being that the states of non-zero h are in Bose-Fermi pairs that don't contribute to the index. So in any event, the trace comes only from states of zero energy. It's more commonly informally written as trace minus 1 to the f, although the previous formula is the precise one, because the Hilbert space is being infinite dimensional. Trace minus 1 to the f doesn't really converge. It needs the regularization that's involved in going back here. But anyway, with this motivation, so by formally taking beta equals 0, at least in the notation, the index is usually called trace minus 1 to the f, which was in the title of the lecture. So as you can see, a non-zero index implies that E of V is zero. And since the index is inherently invariant under continuous deformations, it's highly computable. We're really interested in what happens for large V, because for large V, we'll approach the relativistic theory of infinite volume. But the index being a constant, we can calculate for small v. And if we've got any quantum field theory we concretely understand, for example, it's supernormalizable, or at least it's asymptotically free, as a consolation, if it wasn't supernormalizable, we're supposed to know how to calculate for small v. So we should be able to calculate this index for small v. And in those theories where there's no problem with compactness, and we can see classically if there's a problem with compactness or not, So in the good cases, when we calculate the index, if it isn't zero, that'll demonstrate supersymmetry unbreaking. This has a lot of important examples, of which I'll tell you about a couple. Although we won't really get to working out details until tomorrow. What I'm going to do in the rest of today's lecture, after answering whatever additional questions there are, is just to set up the examples that we'll apply this criterion to tomorrow. So since we have plenty of time to do that, this is a good time to stop for more questions.
I'm going to just one more.
First of all, it's not completely true that it's never broken, because we could write a theory with a potential like this. And then that theory has no Poincaré invariant vacuum. So, of course, the usual axioms of quantum field theory say that there is a Poincaré invariant vacuum. So therefore, this isn't the theory. But if you just suppress that axiom, this kind of theory obeys all other axioms of quantum field theory. So, therefore, except by fiat, we're not going to be able to prove that the Lorentzian Poincaré group is never broken. I can say that I believe, and maybe we could argue just from the non-compactness of the group, that when that happens, it's always related to a kind of non-compactness, so that you can get an effective criterion for its not happening if the classical theory behaves well at infinity. I believe that intuitively. I don't really know proofs. No? I see Tom shaking his head on that one. Okay. If you could pinpoint my error now, feel free. Otherwise, we'll give you until tomorrow at 11. I'd like to see the examples afterwards, perhaps. Well, I'd question whether those are cases where the vacuum energy is unbounded below. I would question whether those are examples where the vacuum energy is unbounded below. That's why I want to see the actual examples where you claim this. If the vacuum energy, see, I drew this with the vacuum energy unbounded below, but the minimum not attained. I might say that I could draw this classically, which is worse, but then I think it will not be true that all axioms of quantum field theory are obeyed, except the existence of a vacuum. And I suspect your examples will be of this kind. However, I'm making assertions here where I don't know any theorems, even in two dimensions. However, okay. I'm answering you by telling you more or less the worst things I've ever met. But I can tell you that you won't usually meet such things in practice in interesting examples. You'll occasionally meet this one. You should never meet this, because you shouldn't study a theory unless you understand enough that you know this isn't going on. You will occasionally meet this in well-posed problems. In fact, Seibert explained some last year, I think, in the math program we had at the Institute. Any other questions? Yes?
Does any extent indicate where one of the radii of your source is like instead of straight line?
Well, I won't be as quick in answering that as I might have been a year ago. But I think I can safely say that although you might learn a variety of interesting things about a variety of things, I don't know anything you can learn about supersymmetry breaking that way. Any other questions? Okay. Well, in that case, we'll use the rest of today to set up examples that we'll actually study tomorrow. So, to be worth studying this way, they should be examples that classically have no mass gap, have unbroken supersymmetry, and have a reasonable degree of compactness. So we will look at the minimal n equals 1 supersymmetry in 3 and 4 dimensions. We'll sort of have more fun in 4, but we can do 3 for, well, as a much shorter version of the same thing. So we'll do 3 and 4 dimensions. So, by way, first of all, of reminding you of what it is concretely, not by writing it in superspace, but just writing it as an ordinary Lagrangian. So A will be a connection with some compact and connected gauge group G. We won't really assume that G is simply connected. We could even let it be not be connected, but we won't mess up the notation with that. And then to make it supersymmetric, there better be some fermions that can be related by supersymmetry to A. A is in the adjoint representation. That is, a displacement of a connection is one form with values in the adjoint representation. So we can't possibly get supersymmetry unless we have fermions with values in the adjoint representation. So psi alpha, alpha is a spinner index. So alpha runs from 1 up to 2 to the something, where the something depends on the dimension of spacetime. Psi alpha is a spinner field, or Fermi field, with values in the adjoint representation. And minimal simply means we don't have any fields other than those. So the Lagrangian is going to be the minimal Yang-Mills Lagrangian plus the minimal action for the fermions, which involves the Dirac operator. So that will be our Lagrangian. Well, is it supersymmetric, is question A. Now, in answering this question, we're allowed, I was a little bit vague about what a spinner is. If we're in even dimensions, we can restrict ourselves to a spinner of just one kind, for example, positive or negative. And maybe we could let the spinner be in a degenerate spinner representation. But the question we might ask is, with some interpretation of what psi is, what kind of spinner it is this Lagrangian supersymmetric? And the answer is, classically, this Lagrangian is supersymmetric in dimensions 3, 4, 6, and 10, and no others. That's related to the fact that if you subtract 2 from those numbers, you get 1, 2, 4, and 8, which are the dimensions of the division algebras. You have to remember that we're really working in Minkowski space, so our signature is, our metric is of type R1, D minus 1. And from many points of view, a quadratic form R1D minus 1 is like R0D minus 2. And D minus 2 is 1, 2, 6, and 1, 2, 4, and 8, which are the dimensions of the division algebras. So this Lagrangian is supersymmetric in those dimensions, as I believe was first shown by Shirk and Schwartz about 20 years ago. My apologies if I'm getting the wrong attribution. But quantum mechanically, it's actually anomalous for D equals 6 or 10. We nevertheless meet it in string theory together with a bunch of other stuff that cancels the anomalies. But we're trying to not do all that in these lectures. We're just trying to do flat space quantum field theory. And from that point of view, we have to leave aside the D equals 6 and 10 cases, which is maybe just as well because they'd be unnormalizable. And we wouldn't quite know what to do with them. So because of that restriction, we'll actually be limited to D equals 3 and 4. The D equals 4 case is quite interesting, of course, because it's the physical dimension of space-time. And we're studying then the most basic supersymmetric model in space-time, which is a subpiece of any more realistic supersymmetric model that might be used in particle physics. Or if your orientation is different, we have to know this theory as practice before doing the n equals 2 version and doing Donaldson theory. So we'll aim to calculate trace minus 1 to the f for d equals 3 and 4. However, in the d equals 4 case, although we won't completely calculate it for all groups, I'll explain what should happen, but the mathematical computations haven't been done. There's a more refined invariant that I want to explain. For d equals 4, there's also a more refined invariant, which has more information than the index. I might say that after I've computed the index, we'll go back and discuss more physics. And I'll explain that the computation we've done is related to a lot more physics than just the question of whether supersymmetry is broken. And for that, the more refined invariant is important. For supersymmetry breaking, it isn't. The reason there's a more refined invariant is that in d equals 4, there are two kinds of spinners. Well, there are two kinds of spin representations, first of all, which I'll call S plus and S minus. So we've got a fermion field psi, which is a section of S plus tensored with the adjoint representation. And there's also psi bar, which is its complex conjugate if we're in Lorentz signature, which is a section of S minus tensored the adjoint representation. When I wrote the Lagrangian, I said I wasn't being very precise about exactly what kind of spinners there were, and I was asking for what dimensions there's some interpretation that makes it supersymmetric. In four dimensions, since the two kinds of spinners are each other's complex conjugate with Lorentz signature, we have both. Or if you want, we've got a real spinner of rank 4. In 6 or 10 dimensions, there are two kinds of spinners. And the supersymmetric version of the Lagrangian involves taking only one and not the other, which is why there's then an anomaly. Now, because we've got the two kinds of spinners, we've got classically a U1 symmetry, which is called the R symmetry, that counter rotates psi and psi bar. Now, quantum mechanically, you don't really have a U1 symmetry. The reason you don't, which was discovered. It was sort of one of the last bits of the standard model when it was discovered by this mechanism in 1976 that the so-called U1 problem of QCD was resolved. Well, here we're working in Euclidean signature, and I've compactified space-time to a four-sphere. But we could make the same points without compactifying or without changing the signature. It's just prettier to say it on the four-sphere. In the path integral, you meet, among other things, instantons, which are fields where trace F ledge F isn't zero. And in the field of an instanton, the path integral for integrating over the fermions isn't invariant. When we do the quantum path integral, there are infinitely many psi's and infinitely many psi bars. And to claim that the measure is invariant under this transformation, we need to claim that there are as many psi's as psi bars. Of course, as there are infinitely many of each, the only sensible way to claim their equal number is to have a natural pairing between them. And the natural pairing is given by the Dirac operator, which maps an eigenmode of psi to an eigenmode of psi bar. Then they're completely paired except for the zero modes. So there's a chiral asymmetry due to the zero modes, as a result of which, in the appropriate sense, there aren't the same number of psis and psi bars. And then the measure isn't invariant. So under this transformation, the measure transforms as e to the I alpha times the index of the Dirac operator, which just counts how many psis there are without corresponding psi bars, or vice versa. So we only get a symmetry if alpha is such that alpha times the index is always a multiple of 2 pi. For example, if the index could be 1, we'd get no symmetry at all. Alpha would have to be 0 mod 2 pi. But for fermions in the adjoint representation on S4, you find that 2H divides the index, where H is the dual Coxeter number. For example, H is n plus 1 for SUN, and H is 30 for E8. So, and there's no better divisibility than that. The index can be any multiple of 2H. But for a suitable bundle on S4, you can get any integral multiple of 2H. So the path integral is a sum of pieces that transform like this with different values of the index. A symmetry means a value of alpha such that this factor is always 1. And alpha then has to be 2 pi times 1 over 2H times an integer. The original question on R4, for example? It doesn't matter. You see, the index, the instanton can be found locally. Instead of precisely defining it by topological invariant, we have a field which is a pure gauge outside a little ball and has a non-zero integral here. And then the discussion of how to pair the psi pluses and psi minuses is more subtle, but the correct regularized number is still given by the same index formula. In general, there would be a correction due to phase shifts at infinity, but here we can take the bundle to be, the connection to be trivial at infinity, and there's no correction to phase shifts at infinity. So the formula is still valid. It just takes a more complicated discussion. Also, inside of R4, it could have been any 4 manifold, because you can glue a small instanton in on any 4 manifold. The only subtlety is that there will be a correction independent of the bundle if the 4 manifold has a non-zero Pontryagin number mod something. But our 4 manifolds in these lectures will actually have 0 Pontryagin number. So we won't have to get into that. So the effect of that is that the symmetry U1 is broken down to Z sub 2H, which, by the way, would be Z sub 4H if we were doing N equals 2 supersymmetry. But because we're doing n equals 1, we get z sub 2h. Well, now we can do something which is really more fun than just looking at the index and gives a lot more information about questions that I haven't mentioned yet, which is, instead of just crudely saying that we have 4, instead of just looking at a real basis for the q's, which I've implicitly done throughout this lecture, I'll take a basis of the q's where I'll take 2 complex q's that are in the plus Finner representation. These transform as S plus. And then, of course, we've got their complex conjugates, which transform as S minus. And now, I let q equal any linear combination of the q alpha. And I work in this subspace of Hilbert space where P is 0 again, where P is the momentum. So now I've got this formula that H is Q anti-commutative with Q bar, from which one proves in the standard fashion that the kernel of H is the same as the cohomology of Q. To be more exact about it, we now take our quantum Hilbert space and decompose it as a sum of two H pieces labeled by characters of that finite group, Z sub 2H. And I forgot here to write that Q squared and Q bar squared are zero, which was implicit in saying that you should take the cohomology. Q maps HI to HI plus 1. And so you can take the kernel of Q modulo its co-kernel for each I. So you get two H cohomology groups. WI, let's say, is the kernel of Q restricted to HI modulo the image of Q mapping HI minus 1 to HI. Okay. We've got a group Z sub 2H acting on the Hilbert space. So we can decompose the Hilbert space according to the characters of that finite group. And HI is the subspace. Well, I is kind of an unfortunate name for it. HJ is the subspace in which e to the I alpha acts by e to the I alpha times J. In other words, it acts by the jth character of the finite group. The reason that Q maps one to the next is that back classically, since psi went to e to the I alpha psi, likewise Q went to e to the I alpha Q under the symmetry. So when you act with Q, you pick up an extra factor of e to the I alpha. So Q maps each Hilbert space to the next one. So we can calculate the cohomology of Q for each I. And now you see, the operator minus 1 to the F is 1 or minus 1 on HJ for J even or odd. So before, we just had the kernel and co-kernel in even and odd spaces. But not kernel and co-kernel. We had the kernel of H in even and odd spaces. But now we have the cohomology for each I. We could, if we wanted, add up the even guys and add up the odd guys and get back to what we had before. So trace minus 1 to the F is the sum of minus 1 to the J times the dimension of WJ. We could calculate the index more easily a little bit than we can calculate the individual W's, but it's more fun to calculate the W's. No, we're going to relax that in a little bit. That'll be the last thing I'll say today. So, because of the periodicity that in the index J of WJ, J is only defined mod 2H, you could think of these groups as living on the handles of a sphere, but circling it. Here I've tried to write 2H points, although I'm not sure I wrote an even or odd number. Okay. There are 2H points, which are meant to be evenly spaced on a circle. And you can think of them as the HJs and then QX from one to the next. There's a cohomology group at each point on the circle. So this is a kind of 2H graded cohomology theory. If we did N equals 2 supersymmetry, this would have been 4H graded. And what we would have defined here would have been the four groups. Except that since we didn't twist, we only have, well, okay. Those who've heard me, for example, or other physicists explain the four groups from this quantum field theory in the past, know that usually you've got to twist the supersymmetric field theory to get Donaldson theory and Fourier theory. But here we were on a flat manifold, so we really didn't have to twist. So, had we made precisely the same construction for n equals 2, we would have gotten T through the torus being flat, we would have gotten the four groups without having to bother twisting. And they would have been graded mod 4H instead of mod 2H. The most familiar case is SU2, where H is 2, and 4H is 8. And the usual four groups are graded mod 8. Okay. The last thing I'll say, are there questions now?
I'm still very confused how to get these indices. You always have to compactify.
We only define this by compactifying space to be a torus. So we have an a priori Hilbert space in which everything is defined where we calculate this cohomology. In infinite volume, we really wouldn't have that. Then there's a different Hilbert space for each choice of vacuum, and since we don't know what the vacuum are, we wouldn't know how to get started with the problem. But we start in... Also, we wouldn't know how to calculate. The fun about this is we start in a finite volume. There's a question from my exposition so far, which you should ask, which is why, in what sense the cohomology groups are independent of the volume. I only proved that the index was independent of the volume. Maybe I'll skip right now trying to prove that cohomology groups are independent of the volume. We start in finite volume. For small volume, we can actually calculate these invariants. And then, because they're independent of the volume, we can also we know the answer for large volume, and that tells us something about what would have happened before compactifying. That's the basic strategy.
Yes? The refined index the same as the G index for this finite group?
There isn't the G index because the group doesn't commute with Q. A g-index is for where the group commutes with the supercharge. And then for each character, you can make a group. When, instead of commuting with the supercharge is in the character of the group. One does this instead. Any other questions? Well, the last thing I'll say is that we can extend this, and in fact, for physical applications, we should, to the case where g is not simply connected. Now, it then follows that on Tk minus 1, there are different G bundles. And we should calculate this index and, moreover, compute these cohomology groups if we're in four dimensions for every G bundle, every topological choice of G bundle. So we run this story. For each topological type of G bundle on Tk minus 1. By the way, we don't specify the bundle on Tk minus 1 times R. In other words, when time evolves, there could be instantons localized in time. But whatever can be measured just on space as a topological invariant is, of course, a constant of the motion. But we might as well set up the quantum theory for each value of those constants. Well, if you know your topology in low dimensions, okay, we're going to take G to be connected, not because it's necessary, but just so we can state a simple answer more quickly. If G is connected, the bundles are classified by an invariant W, maybe I thought M, M in H2 of the torus with values in pi 1 of G. It would be the second Seifel-Whitney class if G were SON. If G were SON, then pi 1 would be Z2. And an SON bundle would be classified in this low dimension. Okay. K minus 1 is at most 3. I'm using that here. In our examples, K minus 1 is 2 or 3. And in that, K minus 1 is no bigger than 3. So, that being so, the G bundles on the torus are classified by a two-dimensional invariant, which if the group were SON would be the second Siebel Whitney class. And physicists call it the magnetic flux. That's why I decided to call it M. So here we're actually asking a question that doesn't have an obvious meaning in the infinite volume limit. That's why we'll have to go back later to discuss what that means. Because in infinite volume, the bundles were all trivial in space. But nevertheless, the dependence of the index on the magnetic flux means something in terms of the infinite volume physics. There's also something else you can do which is called the electric flux. For this, I should state more precisely what I mean by doing gauge theory of a non-simply connected group. So the bundle has for its structure group G. And the connection is a G-value connection on that bundle. But now we should discuss what's the gauge equivalence relation on such connections. It makes sense, given a gauge transformation, it makes sense to ask, well, there's a group of gauge transformations. G1 is the group of G gauge transformations, G little. G0 is the group of G gauge transformations. It contains a subgroup, say the G hat, which is the group, G1, which is the group of gauge transformations for the simply connected cover. For instance, if G is SO, then you would take G hat to be spin. Now, if you've got a gauge transformation, it makes sense to ask, if you go around a circle on the torus, whether it comes back to itself or only modulo the center. The ones that only come back to themselves modulo the center make sense in G gauge theory. So we could impose the full gauge equivalence relation and identify two fields that differ by any gauge transformation. But it's more fun if we only impose the littler gauge equivalence relation. We ask that we say that we consider two connections to be equivalent only if they're equivalent under connections, under gauge transformations that make sense in the simply connected group. So we can do the quantum field theory there. I'll make very precise now what we would lose if we imposed the bigger gauge equivalence relation. Well, for manifolds in general, it wouldn't be a component. Yeah. If it's a component, that's because we're in lower dimension. Right. It might be a sum of components. Yeah. Does everyone understand what we're doing, though, since I don't think I said it well? In SO3, we could have a gauge transformation, which changes by a 2-pi rotation as you go around the circle. It makes sense as an SO3 gauge transformation, but we don't want to impose it. We only want to divide by gauge transformations, which come back to themselves, even in SU2, not just in SO3. So we divide by G0 only in doing quantum mechanics. G1 only. We divide only by the little group in doing the quantum mechanics. So the quotient of the big group by the little one acts on the Hilbert space. Okay. G1, I should say, is a normal subgroup of G0. So G0 mod G1 is a group. And after we've divided by G1, G0 acts. So this quotient gamma is, I believe, H1 of the torus with values in pi 1 of 2. So we've got that finite group acting on our quantum Hilbert space. And we can decompose the quantum Hilbert space under characters of that finite group. The question is almost asking whether it would have made sense to divide by the big group. If there was objective representation, we couldn't have divided by the big group. So, so it would have been a kind of global anomaly that would have given some difficulties in the big theory. And there are a variety. Well, it won't happen in this problem, or it won't happen in the examples we'll look at, but there would be. The general answer to your question is we should have done some work at the beginning to make sure that the theory is completely free of all quantum mechanical anomalies. There will be a variety of theories that have a variety of kinds of anomalies. The ones we're going to look at, of course, won't. It wouldn't be hard to prove it in an ad hoc fashion for those particular examples. But I don't really want to discuss anomalies systematically. This particular thing, though, on the torus, it would be very hard to find an example where you'd have trouble. So, it's a question we could worry about, but we won't, I think. Okay. We'll accept that gamma actually acts. I have a feeling you could disprove it with SL3Z, though, in this example, practically. I think in this example, there are a variety of ways you could show that there's no problem. So now we decompose the Hilbert space as a direct sum of what I'll call E, of H sub E, where E is a character of gamma. See, gamma commutes with the supercharges. So here we just have a decomposition and an index, not just an index, but that whole cohomology decomposition if we're in 3 plus 1 dimensions for every E. So the variables our index depends on, trace minus 1 to the F, is actually a function of M and E. So M lives in H2 of the torus with values in pi 1 of G, and E lives in com into U1 of H1 of the torus with values in pi 1 of G. Electric magnetic duality is supposed to tell you the exact relation between those two groups, which I'm afraid I got hopelessly confused about in trying to prepare the lecture. So I'd have wanted to say, for example, if it were true that these groups were the same. And in case they weren't the same, I wanted to tell you exactly how they were related mathematically. But I got too confused. So perhaps I'll leave this as homework for the audience, which I suspect for some of you won't be hard. And then you can tell me the answer. These groups are either the same or else there's a canonical duality between them. And if both of those statements are false, then you're supposed to make the correct statement, which is analogous to it. Oh, sorry. The duality is in the case of k equals 3, so when the 3... k equals 4, so when the 3 torus. Right. If k is 3, so we're on the 2 torus. I have no question here. We still have this M and E, but there's no claim of a duality between them. I guess I'll stop here. For k equals 3, I'd appreciate a precise statement of relation among these groups. No, k equals 4, sorry. K equals 4. K equals 4. For the 3 torus. Yeah? Pi 1 of G is a point at the billion group. Well, there was a topological statement I made that nobody contradicted. I hope it was true.
Yeah.
That G bundles on the torus.
Yeah.
Because we're in a low dimension where we don't meet Pontryagin classes and so on, and because the group was connected so that we didn't see anything on the one scalar, G bundles were classified by H2 of the torus with values in the finite group.
Yeah.
I think that that's true. I believe so. Okay. Then I asserted that the quotient of the big gauge group by the little one was H upper 1 of the torus with values in pi 1. I believe that was also true, although you can check it if you wish. And then our character group was homomorphisms of that into U1. Okay. Well, I won't say any more to that. I don't know if there are more questions. Okay. Good deal.